In the week that the President of the United States was admitted to hospital with COVID-19, this is the very first Boggle Docs. What's the point of doing CPD that you're not going to use? I find that if I put something into practice soon after learning it, then that information sticks much better in my brain. We're all Boggle Docs in our own way, and we often have no idea about what our patients are going to bring through the door next. But what if we could at least have an inkling of what might be on our patient's problem list so that we'd know what we need to know? Boggle Docs is the new podcast for GPs and other primary care professionals that takes the pulse of the nation by looking at the medical media and uses that information as a springboard to help you target your CPD. Each week, we're going to look at the general picture of what's going on in the newspaper health pages, daytime TV, online, and even radio if it's relevant. Nothing's off limits, and some of the big TV dramas we'll get a look into. We'll also take some time to chat to a fellow medical colleague about a featured programme in more detail. And there we are, the first one. And I should say hello. My name's Nick Kendrew. I'm a GP. I'm also passionate about primary care and about the medical media. And I thought, well, why don't we put them both together in a podcast? And so each week, I'm also going to be joined by a guest. And this week, I'm joined by Rachel Morris. Hi, Rachel. How are you?
I'm very well, Nick. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks very much for joining us on the very first Boggle Docs. And I just wondered if you could introduce yourself to everybody, please.
Oh, so I'm Rachel Morris. I'm a GP, turn executive and team coach. I'm a lead managed Thrive presenter for Redwell, and I work mainly in the resilience industry and wellbeing, so helping people thrive in their workplace. So I do a lot of coaching and training around wellbeing and productivity.
Excellent. Well, thank you for joining us. And of course, you also host the podcast You Are Not a Frog, which I've been on a couple of, well, actually three times now.
You're a star guest, Nick.
Well, thank you very much. That's very kind of you. Don't know about that, but it's always fun to go on, and I always learn something about myself, and always probably end up getting a bit choked up about something as well. So
I think we're going to start running a sweepstake. Time before Nick Nick wells up.
Totally. Yes, exactly. Somebody's going to kick me under the table. Okay, so Rachel is joining us to talk about a few bits and pieces today. First of all, she's going to talk about a news story after the news headlines. And then later on, she's going to join me to talk about the documentary that was on BBC this week, which was Freddie Flintoff living with bulimia. So without further ado, let's look at the headlines. So here we go, reading the paper so you don't have to, and I start by taking one for the team. It's the Mail, sorry, but they're reporting that physiotherapy is as good as surgery for fixing frozen shoulder that blights the lives of 1 in 10 Britons, UK surgeons have found. Now, this is quoting a paper that's been released in The Lancet recently. I've read the article a few times. I can't actually find a mention in The Lancet as such in that article. However, it's also reported in the National Institute for Health Research. This is basically a randomised controlled trial carried out in 35 UK hospitals where 503 patients were randomised to receiving either arthroscopic capsular release or manipulation under anaesthesia or early structure physiotherapy with a steroid injection, which was a treatment specifically designed for the trial that doesn't require a general anaesthetic. And they concluded that none of the treatments were shown to be superior. Moving on now to The Telegraph and their headline. Apple Watch risks overloading medical services, say researchers. A new medical paper warns the product's abnormal pulse detection tool could create a wave of false positives. They report that in a paper for the Journal of the American Medical Informatics Association, researchers from the US-based Mayo Clinic expressed concern that the alerts or messages people receive from their watch could prompt them to visit their doctor unnecessarily. I suspect we all knew that already, didn't we? Basically, small numbers, only 264 people. And the other thing is that Apple state that the ECG function shouldn't be used for people under 22. 10%, well, 8.7% of patients in this study were under the age of 22. Make of that what you will. The British Heart Foundation have commented on this, and they said that the medical community is only beginning to understand the benefits and drawbacks of this technology. They say that although smartwatches have potential for spotting an irregular heartbeat before the wearer displays any noticeable symptoms, more research is needed to determine how this data can be generated to put to the best possible use. Moving on to The Mirror now. And they have a headline that strikes fear into the hearts of anybody that's ever done finals. Health problems your fingernails can indicate, from white spots to ridges. They're quoting a nutritionist who's going through all the different things that nails can show up from, ridges and lines and white spots and clubbing and all that kind of stuff. I would recommend maybe going back to geekymedics.com. They have a great clinical science of the hand article, which will refresh your memory all about those things that you learn for finals, including things like all the different causes of clubbing, of which there are many, I seem to remember. So maybe have a read of that, because if your patients come to you about their nails and what they read in the mirror, then perhaps you'll be really hot on that and be able to go, oh, I know all about that. And let's have a look. So there you go. That's the headlines for now. And Rachel, I believe you got your own story there.
So, how to take the perfect breath, why learning to breathe properly could change your life.
Sounds good.
This is interesting to me. I'll tell you, there's a little bit of the backstory for this with me. I love listening to podcasts. Well, I would do, obviously, hosting one myself. And I presume people listening to this will also like the medium of podcasts. Mm-hmm. And there's an absolutely fantastic podcast called Feel Better, Live More with Dr. Rongan Chatterjee, who is also a GP.
Yes.
And he just seems to get the best people on. You know, any new book about well-being, productivity, stress management, living well, he will get the author on. So just a word of warning, if you listen to this podcast, you will end up spending a fortune on books.
Yes.
Every time I listen to it.
Dangerous for me to listen to as well, because I literally am a dream for a salesperson. I just believe everything they tell me, and then I have to go and buy it straight away.
Yeah. Any bit. I think the problem with some podcasts is you tend to gravitate to the stuff you agree with, or the stuff that you think, oh, I know about that. That'll be interesting. This time I noticed one saying changing the way you breathe will transform your life. I thought, hang on a sec, I'm not that convinced about this whole breath thing. So I'd like to find out a bit more about it. And there's a chap on there called James Nestor, who's just got a new book out called Breath. And I think that's why these headlines are coming up, have been coming up over the later summer and into the autumn, because there's this new book out. James Nestor is a journalist, and he was a bit on the fence about, you know, just, you know, surely we can all breathe, right? We're human beings. We take 25,000 breaths a day. We know how to breathe. So how can you say that we're not breathing that's going to make a difference? But as he looked into it and did more research into breathing, he became more convinced that learning to breathe properly has huge amounts of health benefits. Now, sort of as someone who does a lot of training for people in resilience and stuff, I always knew that taking deep breaths and sort of focusing on breath can be very helpful in terms of meditating and maybe helping you reduce stress, because it made you feel a bit nicer.
Yeah.
But actually, when you start to hear the science of breathing and breathing properly, you start to realize how actually it makes a lot of sense physiologically. So, you know, if you are about to be chased by a tiger, your breathing will get really, really fast, because you know, that is in your sympathetic nervous system, making you breathe fast, and you need to be able to run very fast. Now, the problem is a lot of us breathe too fast normally, which is sending messages to our brains that something's wrong, and it's activating our sympathetic nervous system. So it's automatically making us feel stressed and causing spikes in circulating adrenaline, which of course causes vasoconstriction and puts up your blood pressure. So actually how we breathe has a massive effect on our health, because it determines whether we're in our sort of sympathetic heightened arousal state or in our parasympathetic state. And just the act of slowing down your breathing can activate your parasympathetic nervous system and your vagal nerve, and actually cause your body to go into a much more relaxed state, as if you were sort of sitting around the fire when we were living in caves, you know, talking to your pals, as opposed to hunting and gathering and running away from the tiger.
So is this something that you have to practice, or is this something that just becoming more aware of it is good enough, or is it a bit of both?
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, the first thing that James Nestor said was, firstly, nasal breathing is massively important, because you actually get 20% more oxygen into your lungs if you breathe through your nose, because you humidify it properly, and because of the pressure and because it goes through all your nasal passages, it will go down to the bottom of your lungs. Whereas mouth breathing, you probably only fill up a certain amount of your lungs. It doesn't go up to the right. So actually just getting enough oxygen, and some really top athletes are now only using nasal breathing in their training, because it's so much better for you.
Wow.
So it's really good physiologically. And yes, it does take some practice sometimes to learn how to slow your breathing down. And they're saying, sort of, a breath rate of 6 to 8 per minute is actually one of the optimal breath rates. I mean, most of us breathe at a rate of between 12 and 16. So just slowing stuff down can be really important. And that does take practice. And there's all sorts of breath practices. But of course, it's nothing new. And that's what's interesting about this article is someone who started doing breath practice, and she was a yoga teacher. And of course, there's a lot of yoga practices that have breath work. And, you know, a lot of the ancient religious traditions all have breath work in them, etc. So I think it's just really interesting. And it's something that I definitely want to explore more, you know, really just learning to breathe through your nose and to slow your breathing down. Will that properly have health benefits? And the interesting thing is that James Nestor was saying is that when we have panic attacks and when we're in that panicky state, we have a very low end-tidal CO2 because obviously we're over-breathing, we're flushing out our carbon dioxide, and that can cause all those tingling feelings in our hands and those panicky stuff. So actually, can breath work really help our anxiety? Can it help our normal resting physiological state? If we're feeling stressed, we often think, oh, it's because there's something happened that made me feel stressed. Maybe we're just breathing wrong and we need to change our physiology. And then that will have the feedback of relaxing us. And, you know, for me, it's all very fascinating. Am I talking sense?
You're absolutely talking sense. And it's also one of those things that if somebody's coming to see you, as in your GP surgery, you can talk to them about square breathing, which is similar to what you're talking about. It's about controlling the breathing. And so basically you breathe in for four, hold it for four, breathe out for four, hold it for four, breathe in for four. And it's about slowing it down. And often if you get quite an anxious person, you can then demonstrate how much better they can feel having done that for a few minutes. And it's something that actually fits quite well. There's not much that you can do in a 10-minute consultation, but that kind of thing can sometimes make a difference, I have found. So yeah.
I think it's massively important. And the great thing about it, it's something you can access anywhere. You don't need to go to a special class. You don't need to spend a lot of money. You can literally sit in front of the telly and do some square breathing.
Brilliant. So thank you for that, Rachel. And now it's time to talk about daytime TV. And this week we're going to focus on This Morning, which has been on air since 1988. It's now presented by Philip Schofield and Holly Willoughby. And if you look at the YouGov data, they say that it's more popular with millennials, with 50% of those giving it a positive opinion. And it's also more popular with women, with 50% of women giving it a positive opinion, with only 24% of men giving it a positive opinion. Now, let's start with Monday, when they had former Love Island star Chris Hughes. He was on a remote link with his brother Ben, speaking to Dr. Chris Steele, the GP. And they were talking about how Chris had been on This Morning in 2018 showing a live testicular examination to promote self-examination amongst men. That evening, his brother Ben decided to examine himself and found a lump and was then discovered to have testicular cancer, for which he's now had treatment and is recovering well. So they were on to promote their documentary, which is on the BBC now. Me, My Brother and Our Balls is what they talked about. And they talked about Ben's battle with cancer, Chris's problems with his varicocele, and both of their issues with fertility. They were very much advocating, as great to see, testicular self-examination. And so we may well get some patients coming to see us having found a lump, and they might be a bit worried about that. On Tuesday, Chris Steele was back, and he was talking about autumn hay fever. Going through the symptoms, same as summer hay fever, as you'd expect, talking about how pollen from weeds and nettles and various molds can cause it, and that same treatments as we'd expect as well. So we might get patients asking us about that. Philip Schofield asked the killer question, people getting symptoms mixed up with what could be a cold or what could be the start of COVID. So Dr. Chris, he's been on TV since 1988, knew exactly how to deal with this. Let's keep it simple, he said. Think of hay fever with sneezing and itching. Think of a cold, common cold, as being more bunged up in the nose. COVID is a new onset, persistent dry cough, fever, loss of sense of smell or taste. Of course, 40% of patients with COVID can be asymptomatic. So he basically says, I think if you've had hay fever, you know the symptoms, you get them every year. If you think you've got COVID, then you need to get tested. So that was his advice. Also on Tuesday, they had Meg Matthews, who's written a book about the menopause, The New Hot, Taking on the Menopause with Attitude and Style is her book. And she was advocating the use of body identical HRT. So it's worthwhile just being aware of that, because body identical HRT is regulated and it's available on the NHS, whereas bioidentical hormones are not regulated and are only available privately. Philip Schofield flagged up the fact that when they've discussed the menopause and HRT before on This Morning, that when you say HRT, people think cancer. So we should be aware of that. That's a really good insight into what our patients might be thinking. So we need to be aware of what they think and what they worry about, and we can counsel them accordingly. We had on Wednesday, Dr. Nigat was on. You may know that she's also been on BBC Breakfast quite a few times. So she splits between the two programmes. And in fact, we had a poll recently basically asking what was the best source of medical advice on daytime TV for our patients. On Twitter, she was saying, oh, which way do I vote? So I wonder which way she voted. But she was on This Morning this time talking about the flu vaccination programme, giving us all the latest about that. And some GP surgeries and pharmacies have been reported as experiencing a shortage, but she very much said there is no supply shortage, so reassuring the nation, which is great to see. Talking about the biggest flu vaccination in history, Dr. Nigat was saying that it's an ambitious program, aiming to keep people well and not to overwhelm primary care or A&E. She went through all the different groups that are included, and including the expansion for the age group from 50 to 64, also including year 7 children, and also including household contacts of those on the NHS shielded patient list. So that was really good and really reassuring for all of our patients to see that, and hopefully they'll all come and get their flu jabs. Then on Thursday we had Dr. Zoe Williams talking in great detail and great passion about sickle cell disease, talking about it being a genetic condition due to a gene mutation, going into all the ins and outs of it, and it can only be cured from a stem cell transplant, talking about the use of hydroxycarbamide to reduce crises as well, talking about how babies get tested at birth and women are tested when they're pregnant, and also saying that you can get, you can request a test from your GP. So we might get patients asking us about that, particularly anybody who has a family history of sickle cell disease, or if your partner is a known carrier, it's worth knowing what your status is. And she was also saying how there is a need for people from the Black community to give blood and to get on the stem cell register. Also on the same show, they were talking about the fact that it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Liz Hurley was on there. She is a breast cancer advocate for a well-known cosmetic chain. And she was saying that she is going to be taking part on the 21st of October with Dr. Zoe Williams on a big virtual event called Time to Unite, which will be basically demonstrating how to self-examine your breasts, which, as I said, is all part of Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And then finally on Friday, there was Dr. Michael Mosley talking with Eamon and Ruth about intermittent fasting. And they were talking to Dr. Ethan Wise, who basically was doing a study into intermittent fasting, the 16-8 plan, where you eat for 8 hours a day in a window of 8 hours and you would fast for 16 hours a day. And Dr. Wise was saying that sadly, because he was a very great advocate for this, his study hadn't shown that there was sort of much evidence for intermittent fasting of that kind, whereas Michael Mosley was making the point that and he looked into things like the 5-2 diet, he still stood by all of the evidence for that. Ah, so that was This Morning. And next week we're going to be looking in more detail about BBC Breakfast, and I wonder if we'll see any of the This Morning doctors on BBC Breakfast next week. Now it's time to talk about our feature programme of the week, and Rachel is back with me, and we're going to be talking about Freddie Flintoff, Living with Bulimia, which was on BBC One this week and is still available on the iPlayer. So Rachel, what do you think?
Oh my word, what a moving programme.
Absolutely.
I mean, normally when you watch these things, it's someone who's had a problem, has gone through it and has worked out what they want to do about it and is much better, so they're telling their story. But this was him, I guess it was, for me, it was almost a journey of him realizing that he had a real problem.
Yeah, it was really powerful. And I also thought that as I was watching it, that this kind of thing, because obviously the whole sort of point about this podcast is looking at things that would bring our patients to see us. And because I think it's so raw, this one, and then it is about his discovery and almost like the realization that he does need to get some help, I think that makes it even more powerful and more likely for our patients to think and really identify with it and really think, I need to go and get some help about this.
I think he was really brave making it. I mean, yeah. Hats off to him. I think it was such a brave thing to do. And the fact that he let them film him when he's just sort of, he, what really struck me was that time where he goes to, I think it was the Maudsley, and he sits in on a consultation with a man with bulimia and the consultant. And he thinks he's just there to sort of interview them about what it was. And it turns out that they're interviewing him, and he's just sort of sitting there realizing that he's got almost exactly the same symptoms of this chap who has been getting help. And at one point he sort of chokes up and says, oh, I never cry. And there he is sort of choking up, I think, as he begins to realise that other people have gone through that too. And he's not on his own, but
exactly,
he really does need to get some help.
And what actually, you just saying that right now has just made me thought of something, because you saying that when he was welling up and saying, I don't normally cry, for me watching it, it felt like it was almost like a study in somebody keeping a cork in a bottle, in that he was desperately trying to keep a lid on it. And he kept saying to himself, you know, I'm okay. In fact, I've wrote a few things down saying, just quoting him saying, I'm in control of this. I can stop doing this whenever I want. This is an illness. This is me. I'm sorry. This is not an illness. This is me. And at one point he says, I've got a lid on this. And then he says, am I worse than I thought? I think I'm okay. And it's all those things. And I think once he started talking to those other people and he started welling up, that's when it kind of felt like he'd realized that there was more to this. And it just felt to me when watching it that he was just exhausted with trying to keep a lid on it and trying to keep going and trying to say that he's okay. Because that, even if it's not an eating disorder, any kind of condition where you're trying to put on a front, and he's doing this in front of the media and trying to keep a happy face on all the time, that is absolutely exhausting. And I just thought it was just such a powerful piece of TV.
Hats off to him. And it's just so sad when you saw that, you know, they showed the clips of the headline saying, you know, Fat Freddy, and all the cricket commentators going, well, he's a big lad, isn't he? And it just made me think, you know, we think it's quite normal for women to be fairly obsessed with their weight and what they look like. And, you know, I've certainly experienced, you know, wanting to be thinner and wanting to be that and thinking about my weight. And you don't often realize that this is the same for guys as well. And it can be real, you know, looking at him, you would never think that he would be spending the whole time thinking about, has he put on a few pounds? Has he not? Can he pinch more than an inch? Whatever. And for me, the real key moment came at the end where he goes back to see the psychiatrist, and, or it might be the dietitian, but one of them says to him, the bulimia is, you know, that is just the symptom of the underlying illness, which is this eating, this relationship with food that you have, and this constant anxiety around food and worrying about your body image. And then the bulimia is what you do to then try and manage that. And it just came home to me that so often we spend our time focusing on the symptoms rather than the actual causes. And what he needed was to really re-examine his whole body image and his whole, you know, attitude to anxiety around food. And it just I think sometimes we can minimize or trivialize particularly things such as bulimia, as it is quite common, isn't it? But it just brought home to me about how important, how destructive it is for people.
Yeah, exactly. And the statistic is that 25% of eating disorders are in men. And anorexia only accounts for 15% of eating disorders. So with his bulimia, you know, it's something that we might not particularly consider for men. And also the thing that struck me was that you could completely understand why he got to where he was, because when you look at all the media coverage, I mean, anybody would get a complex about that. But then I was thinking that actually, you know, not all of us are in the public eye like that at all. So trying to make it more relevant to our patients and what they might come to us about it. And it can just be a throwaway comment from somebody that you're in a relationship with, or it can be, say, if you've been through a bit of a messy breakup, it's a very easy thing for somebody to focus on and to tell somebody that they're fat. And you know, those kind of things are what's going to bring our patients to see us. And you know, watching that program, they're going to be thinking, what can they do? How can they get help? And I think, so from our perspective, it's important to realise that with the NICE guidelines that came out on eating disorders in 2017, that it's not about BMIs. It's actually, if you think somebody's got an eating disorder, then you need to refer them to the local mental health service to get help for that. It's regardless of BMI. So you refer them as soon as the diagnosis is suspected. And one of the things that we can do is the SCOF screening tool, which is very easy to access online. And you score one for each of these sort of questions, which I'm going to ask in a second. And if you score more than two, or equal to, or more than two, then it indicates a possible eating disorder. So the first question is, have you ever felt so uncomfortably full that you've made yourself sick? So obviously Freddie would have got a yes to that. Do you ever worry you've lost control over how much you eat? I'm not sure what his answer would be for that, but quite possibly. Have you recently lost or gained more than one stone in a 3-month period? And the next one is, do you believe yourself to be fat when others say that you are too thin? And would you say that food dominates your life? So that's the SCOF question, the SCOF screening tool that we can use with patients come to see us. But I think towards the end of the documentary, what was really powerful, I think they jumped 3 or 4 months. And clearly, I think it was when they'd been in lockdown and he'd taken up cycling on an indoor bike, one of those online sort of bike classes that you can sign up for. And he had markedly lost quite a lot of weight, and he looked very different to how he looked at the beginning of the documentary. And at that point is when he went to go and see the psychiatrist himself to get some help. And I thought that was really, really powerful as well.
Yeah, I must say, when I saw him on that bike, I felt really worried.
Yeah.
You know, I thought, and in fact, Freddie, one of the things that really powerful me, you know, he said, my name is Andrew.
Yeah.
It's not Freddie. Mm. And he's living up to this media portrayal. And I think that may be one of the reasons why eating disorders in men can be much more hidden or whatever, because there's this sort of sometimes this macho thing around, you know, just laughing at each other all the time and calling someone a fat lad. You know, it's just banter, isn't it? I don't think you'd ever call a woman a fat lass to their face type thing, you know.
Or at all, I would hope.
what he went through was just unbelievable. Even the dietitian who's supposed to be looking after the team, you know, he couldn't talk, you know, you think he could have gone to talk to the dietitian about it, but she said, oh no, men don't get eating disorders. So I think, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if following this documentary there will be quite a few guys and women who come out of the woodwork and really identify with that and say, you know, it's me. Because I think another thing about bulimia, you don't need to be making yourself sick to have bulimia. That was another really interesting thing to me. There's a lot of other symptoms within that spectrum.
Exactly. And I think the other thing that really was brought home to me was the fact, because he clearly, when he was going to speak to the dietitian, 15 years ago or whenever it was in the 90s or so, he went to, you know, plucked up all his courage, and then because he wasn't heard and not helped at that point, then this is where we are now. And it really brings it home that, you know, when our patients come to us, they've clearly had a journey to get to us about that particular condition, and they've thought it all through and about what, you know, what they see as what help looks like. And we need to be able to meet that need. And that's why it's so important for us to be sort of getting our resources ready, so that if somebody does come in to talk to us about that, then we can get them the help they need. And it's not going to be a case of them coming back 2 or 3 times before they actually get the help.
I think the other thing that was very powerful was that I think the thing that helped him most was talking to other sufferers who said, look, this is what I've been through. This is the help I got. And that seems to hit home more. So I think, you know, don't underestimate the significance of support groups and patients forums and things that will help people know that they're in the same boat. And, you know, I think stories is really helpful for people, aren't they? So
absolutely. And
yeah,
there were lots of statistics quoted in the documentary as well, and some of them that hit home to me were that eating disorders cause more deaths than any other mental illness. And it says that 60% of men with eating disorders don't seek professional help. And you can kind of understand why that is from the documentary. So that is Freddie Flintoff, Living with Bulimia, which is available still on the iPlayer. And if you haven't seen it, I would really recommend watching it just because it's such an important piece of of television and documentary making. And I think it will really help us to empathise with patients that come through our doors to talk to us about this. And of course, we wish Andrew Flintoff nothing but the best in his ongoing battle and hopefully recovery from bulimia. Thanks for joining me today, Rachel.
Thanks so much for having me, Nick.
Take care and see you again soon.
Bye.
Cheers. Bye. And that is just about it. Thank you so much for listening to the very first Boggle Docs. We have covered so much in the last half an hour. Don't forget, well, we've talked about frozen shoulders and Apple Watches and nail problems, all to sort of maybe look up and get genned up on in case our patients talk to us about that. Talking about daytime TV this morning was giving us the heads up about testicular and breast self-examination, how relevant they are at the moment. Also talking about the flu vaccination program, body identical HRT, all those things, intermittent fasting, sickle cell, loads of things there. And then, of course, that really interesting chat with Rachel all about Andrew Freddy Flintoff talking about his bulimia and about how we can help our patients with that. So thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.